Catherine's final words echoed through the hush of his tomb. The secret hides within. Strangely, Langdon realized he had heard these exact words many times before. The secret hides within. Even now, it seemed, the ancient mysteries were taunting him. The secret hides within was the core tenet of the mysteries, urging mankind to seek God not in the heavens above, but rather within himself. The secret hides within. It was the message of all the great mystical teachers. The kingdom of God is within you, said Jesus Christ. Know thyself, said Pythagoras. Know ye not that ye are gods? Said Hermes Trismegistus. The list went on and on. All the mystical teachings of the ages had attempted to convey this one idea. The secret hides within. Even so, mankind continued looking to the heavens for the face of God. This realization, for Langdon, now became an ultimate irony. Right now, with his eyes facing the heavens like all the blind men who preceded him, Robert Langdon suddenly saw the light. It hit him like a bolt from above. The secret hides within the order, 8 Franklin Square. In a flash he understood. The message on the capstone was suddenly crystal clear. Its meaning had been staring him in the face all night. The text on the capstone, like the Masonic pyramid itself, was a symbolon, a code in pieces, a message written in parts. The capstone's meaning was camouflaged in so simple a manner that Langdon could scarcely believe he and Catherine had not spotted it. More astonishing still, Langdon now realized that the message on the capstone did indeed reveal exactly how to decipher the grid of symbols on the base of the pyramid. It was so very simple. Exactly as Peter Solomon had promised, the golden capstone was a potent talisman with the power to bring order from chaos. Langdon began pounding on the lid and shouting, I know! I know! Above him, the stone pyramid lifted off and hovered away. In its place, the tattooed face reappeared, its chilling visage staring down through the small window. I solved it! Langdon shouted. Let me out! When the tattooed man spoke, Langdon's submerged ears heard nothing. His eyes, however, saw the lips speak two words. Tell me. I will, Langdon screamed, the water almost to his eyes. Let me out! I'll explain everything! It's so simple. The man's lips moved again. Tell me now, or die. With the water rising through the final inch of airspace, Langdon tipped his head back to keep his mouth above the waterline. As he did so, warm liquid poured into his eyes, blurring his vision. Arching his back, he pressed his mouth against the plexiglass window. Then, with his last few seconds of air, Robert Langdon shared the secret of how to decipher the Masonic pyramid. As he finished speaking, the liquid rose around his lips. Instinctively, Langdon drew a final breath and clamped his mouth shut. A moment later, the fluid covered him entirely, reaching the top of his tomb and spreading out across the plexiglass. He did it, Malach realized. Langdon figured out how to solve the pyramid. The answer was so simple, so obvious. Beneath the window, the submerged face of Robert Langdon stared up at him with desperate and beseeching eyes. Malach shook his head at him and slowly mouthed the words, Thank you, Professor. Enjoy the afterlife. Chapter 103. As a serious swimmer, Robert Langdon had often wondered what it would feel like to drown. He now knew he was going to learn firsthand. Although he could hold his breath longer than most people, he could already feel his body reacting to the absence of air. Carbon dioxide was accumulating in his blood, bringing with it the instinctual urge to inhale. Do not breathe. The reflex to inhale was increasing in intensity with each passing moment. Langdon knew very soon he would reach what was called the breath-hold breakpoint, that critical moment at which a person could no longer voluntarily hold his breath. Open the lid! Langdon's instinct was to pound and struggle, but he knew better than to waste valuable oxygen. All he could do was stare up through the blur of water above him and hope. The world outside was now only a hazy patch of light above the plexiglass window. His core muscles had begun burning, and he knew hypoxia was setting in. Suddenly a beautiful and ghostly face appeared, gazing down at him. It was Catherine, her soft features looking almost ethereal through the veil of liquid. Their eyes met through the plexiglass window, and for an instant, Langdon thought he was saved. "Catherine!" Then he heard her muted cries of horror, and realized she was being held there by their captor. The tattooed monster was forcing her to bear witness to what was about to happen.
"Catherine, I'm sorry."
In this strange, dark place, trapped underwater, Langdon strained to comprehend that these would be his final moments of life. Soon he would cease to exist. Everything he was, or had ever been, or would ever be, was ending. When his brain died, all of the memories held in his gray matter, along with all of the knowledge he had acquired, would simply evaporate in a flood of chemical reactions. In this moment, Robert Langdon realized his true insignificance in the universe. It was as lonely and humbling a feeling as he had ever experienced. Almost thankfully, he could feel the breath-hold breakpoint arriving. The moment was upon him. Langdon's lungs forced out their spent contents, collapsing in eager preparation to inhale. Still, he held out an instant longer. His final second. Then, like a man no longer able to hold his hand to a burning stove, he gave himself over to fate. Reflex overruled reason, his lips parted, his lungs expanded, and the liquid came pouring in. The pain that filled his chest was greater than Langdon had ever imagined. The liquid burned as it poured into his lungs. Instantly, the pain shot upward into his skull, and he felt like his head was being crushed in a vise. There was great thundering in his ears, and through it all, Catherine Solomon was screaming. There was a blinding flash of light, and then blackness. Robert Langdon was gone. Chapter 104. It's over. Catherine Solomon had stopped screaming. The drowning she had just witnessed had left her catatonic, virtually paralyzed with shock and despair. Beneath the plexiglass window, Langdon's dead eyes stared past her into empty space. His frozen expression was one of pain and regret. The last tiny air bubbles trickled out of his lifeless mouth. And then, as if consenting to give up his ghost, the Harvard professor slowly began sinking to the bottom of the tank, where he disappeared into the shadows.
"He's gone."
Catherine felt numb. The tattooed man reached down, and with pitiless finality, he slid the small viewing window closed, sealing Langdon's corpse inside. Then he smiled at her.
"Shall we?"
Before Catherine could respond, he hoisted her grief-stricken body onto his shoulder, turned out the light, and carried her out of the room. With a few powerful strides, he transported her to the end of the hall, into a large space that seemed to be bathed in a reddish-purple light. The room smelled like incense. He carried her to a square table in the center of the room and dropped her hard on her back, knocking the wind out of her. The surface felt rough and cold.
"Is this stone?"
Catherine had hardly gotten her bearings before the man had removed the wire from her wrists and ankles. Instinctively, she attempted to fight him off, but her cramped arms and legs barely responded. He now began strapping her to the table with heavy leather bands, cinching one strap across her knees and then buckling a second across her hips, pinning her arms at her sides. Then he placed a final strap across her sternum, just above her breasts. It had all taken only moments, and Catherine was again immobilized. Her wrists and ankles throbbed now as the circulation returned to her limbs.
"Open your mouth,"
the man whispered, licking his own tattooed lips. Catherine clenched her teeth in revulsion. The man again reached out with his index finger and ran it slowly around her lips, making her skin crawl. She clenched her teeth tighter. The tattooed man chuckled, and using his other hand, found a pressure point on her neck and squeezed. Catherine's jaw instantly dropped open. She could feel his finger entering her mouth and running along her tongue. She gagged and tried to bite it, but the finger was already gone. Still grinning, he raised his moist fingertip before her eyes. Then he closed his eyes and once again rubbed her saliva into the bare circle of flesh on his head. The man sighed and slowly opened his eyes. Then, with an eerie calm, he turned and left the room. In the sudden silence, Catherine could feel her heart pounding. Directly over her, an unusual series of lights seemed to be modulating from purple-red to a deep crimson, illuminating the room's low ceiling. When she saw the ceiling, all she could do was stare. Every inch was covered with drawings. The mind-boggling collage above her appeared to depict the celestial sky. Stars, planets, and constellations mingled with astrological symbols, charts, and formulas. There were arrows predicting elliptical orbits, geometric symbols indicating angles of ascension, and zodiacal creatures peering down at her. It looked like a mad scientist had gotten loose in the Sistine Chapel. Turning her head, Catherine looked away, but the wall to her left was no better. A series of candles on medieval floor stands shed a flickering glow on a wall that was completely hidden beneath pages of text, photos, and drawings. Some of the pages looked like papyrus or vellum torn from ancient books. Others were obviously from newer texts. Mixed in were photographs, drawings, maps, and schematics. All of them appeared to have been glued to the wall with meticulous care. A spider web of strings had been thumbtacked across them, interconnecting them in limitless, chaotic possibilities. Catherine again looked away, turning her head in the other direction. Unfortunately, this provided the most terrifying view of all. Adjacent to the stone slab on which she was strapped, there stood a small side counter that instantly reminded her of an instrument table from a hospital operating room. On the counter was arranged a series of objects, among them a syringe, a vial of dark liquid, and a large knife with a bone handle and a blade hewn of iron burnished to an unusually high shine.
My God, what is he planning to do to me?
Chapter 105. When CIA Systems Security Specialist Rick Parrish finally loped into Nola Kay's office, he was carrying a single sheet of paper.
What took you so long? Nola demanded.
I told you to come down immediately.
Sorry, he said, pushing up his bottle-bottom glasses on his long nose. I was just trying to gather more information for you, but...
Just show me what you've got.
Parrish handed her the printout. It's a redaction, but you get the gist. Nola scanned the page in amazement. I'm still trying to figure out how a hacker got access, Parrish said. But it looks like a delegator spider hijacked one of our search...
Forget that,
Nola blurted, glancing up from the page.
What the hell is the CIA doing with a classified file about pyramids, ancient portals, and engraved symbolons?
That's what took me so long. I was trying to see what document was being targeted, so I traced the file path. Parrish paused, clearing his throat. This document turns out to be on a partition personally assigned to the CIA director himself. Nola wheeled, staring in disbelief.
Sato's boss has a file about the Masonic Pyramid?
She knew that the current director, along with many other top CIA executives, was a high-ranking Mason, but Nola could not imagine any of them keeping Masonic secrets on a CIA computer. Then again, considering what she had witnessed in the last 24 hours, anything was possible. Agent Simpkins was lying on his stomach, ensconced in the bushes of Franklin Square. His eyes were trained on the columned entry of the Almas Temple. Nothing. No lights had come on inside, and no one had approached the door. He turned his head and checked on Bellamy. The man was pacing alone in the middle of the park, looking cold, really cold. Simpkins could see him shaking and shivering. His phone vibrated. It was Sato.
How overdue is our target?
She demanded. Simpkins checked his chronograph.
Target said 20 minutes. It's been almost 40.
Something's wrong.
He's not coming,
Sato said.
It's over.
Simpkins knew she was right. Any word from Hartman?
No. He never checked in from Kalorama Heights. I can't reach him.
Simpkins stiffened. If this was true, then something was definitely wrong.
I just called field support,
Sato said.
And they can't find him either.
Holy shit.
Do they have a GPS location on the Escalade?
Yeah, a residential address in Kalorama Heights,
Sato said.
Gather your men. We're pulling out.
Sato clicked off her phone and gazed out at the majestic skyline of her nation's capital. An icy wind whipped through her light jacket, and she wrapped her arms around herself to stay warm. Director Inoue Sato was not a woman who often felt cold or fear. At the moment, however, she was feeling both. Chapter 106. Malach wore only his silk loincloth as he dashed up the ramp, through the steel door, and out through the painting into his living room. I need to prepare quickly. He glanced over at the dead CIA agent in the foyer. This home is no longer safe. Carrying the stone pyramid in one hand, Malach strode directly to his first floor study and sat down at his laptop computer. As he logged in, he pictured Langdon downstairs and wondered how many days or even weeks would pass before the submerged corpse was discovered in the secret basement. It made no difference. Malach would be long gone by then. Langdon has served his role brilliantly. Not only had Langdon reunited the pieces of the Masonic pyramid, he had figured out how to solve the arcane grid of symbols on the base. At first glance, the symbols seemed indecipherable, and yet the answer was simple, staring them in the face. Malach's laptop sprang to life, the screen displaying the same email he had received earlier. A photograph of a glowing capstone, partially blocked by Warren Bellamy's finger. The secret hides within the order. Then Bellamy's finger and Franklin Square. 8 Franklin Square, Catherine had told Malach. She had also admitted that CIA agents were staking out Franklin Square, hoping to capture Malach and also figure out what order was being referenced by the capstone. The Masons? The Shriners? The Rosicrucians? None of these, Malach now knew. Langdon saw the truth. 10 minutes earlier, with liquid rising around his face, the Harvard professor had figured out the key to solving the pyramid.
The order 8 Franklin Square, he had shouted, terror in his eyes. The secret hides within the order 8 Franklin Square.
At first, Malach failed to understand his meaning.
It's not an address,
Langdon yelled, his mouth pressed to the plexiglass window.
The order 8 Franklin Square. It's a magic square.
Then he said something about Albrecht Dürer and how the pyramid's first code was a clue to breaking this final one. Malach was familiar with magic squares, Kameas, as the early mystics called them. The ancient text, De Occulta Philosophia, described in detail the mystical power of magic squares and the methods for designing powerful sigils based on magical grids of numbers. Now Langdon was telling him that a magic square held the key to deciphering the base of the pyramid?
You need an 8x8 magic square, the professor had been yelling,
his lips the only part of his body above the liquid.
Magic squares are categorized in orders. A 3x3 square is an order 3. A 4x4 square is an order 4. You need an order 8.
The liquid had been about to engulf Langdon entirely, and the professor drew one last desperate breath and shouted out something about a famous Mason, an American forefather, a scientist, mystic, mathematician, inventor, as well as the creator of the mystical Kamea that bore his name to this day, Franklin. In a flash, Malach knew Langdon was right. Now, breathless with anticipation, Malach sat upstairs at his laptop. He ran a quick web search, received dozens of hits, chose one, and began reading. The Order 8 Franklin Square. One of history's best-known magic squares is the Order 8 Square, published in 1769 by American scientist Benjamin Franklin, and which became famous for its inclusion of never-before-seen bent diagonal summations. Franklin's obsession with this mystical art form most likely stemmed from his personal associations with the prominent alchemists and mystics of his day, as well as his own belief in astrology, which were the underpinnings for the predictions made in his Poor Richard's Almanac. Malach studied Franklin's famous creation, a unique arrangement of the numbers 1 through 64, in which every row, column, and diagonal added up to the same magical constant. The secret hides within the order 8 Franklin Square. Malach smiled. Trembling with excitement, he grabbed the stone pyramid and flipped it over, examining the base. The square base was segmented, like a chessboard, with each of its 64 squares containing a mystical symbol. These 64 symbols needed to be reorganized and arranged in a different order, their sequence defined by the numbers in Franklin's magic square. Although Malach could not imagine how this chaotic grid of symbols would suddenly make sense in a different order, he had faith in the ancient promise. Ordo ab cau. Heart racing, he took out a sheet of paper and quickly drew an empty 8x8 grid. Then he began inserting the symbols one by one in their newly defined positions. Almost immediately, to his astonishment, the grid began making sense. Order from chaos. He completed the entire decryption and stared in disbelief at the solution before him. A stark image had taken shape. The jumbled grid had been transformed, reorganized. And although Malach could not grasp the meaning of the entire message, he understood enough. Enough to know exactly where he was now headed. The pyramid points the way. The grid pointed to one of the world's great mystical locations. Incredibly, it was the same location at which Malach had always fantasized he would complete his journey. Destiny. Chapter 107. The stone table felt cold beneath Catherine Solomon's back. Horrifying images of Robert's death continued to swirl through her mind, along with thoughts of her brother. Is Peter dead too? The strange knife on the nearby table kept bringing flashes of what might lie in store for her as well. Is this really the end? Oddly, her thoughts turned abruptly to her research, to noetic science, and to her recent breakthroughs. All of it lost, up in smoke. She would never be able to share with the world everything she had learned. Her most shocking discovery had taken place only a few months ago, and the results had the potential to redefine the way humans thought about death. Strangely, thinking now of that experiment was bringing her an unexpected solace. As a young girl, Catherine Solomon had often wondered if there was life after death. Does heaven exist? What happens when we die? As she grew older, her studies in science quickly erased any fanciful notions of heaven, hell, or the afterlife. The concept of life after death, she came to accept, was a human construct, a fairy tale designed to soften the horrifying truth that was our mortality. Or so I believed. A year ago, Catherine and her brother had been discussing one of philosophy's most enduring questions, the existence of the human soul. Specifically, the issue of whether or not humans possessed some kind of consciousness capable of survival outside of the body. They both sensed that such a human soul probably did exist. Most ancient philosophies concurred. Buddhist and Brahminical wisdom endorsed metempsychosis, the transmigration of the soul into a new body after death. Platonists defined the body as a prison from which the soul escaped, and the Stoics called the soul apospasma tou theou, a particle of God, and believed it was recalled by God upon death. The existence of the human soul, Catherine noted with some frustration, was probably a concept that would never be scientifically proven. Confirming that a consciousness survived outside the human body after death was akin to exhaling a puff of smoke and hoping to find it years later. After their discussion, Catherine had a strange notion. Her brother had mentioned the book of Genesis and its description of the soul as neshama,
a kind of spiritual intelligence that was separate from the body. It occurred to Catherine that the word intelligence suggested the presence of thought. Noetic science clearly suggested that thoughts had mass, and so it stood to reason then that the human soul might therefore also have mass. Can I weigh a human soul? The notion was impossible, of course, foolish even to ponder. It was 3 days later that Catherine suddenly woke up from a dead sleep and sat bolt upright in bed. She jumped up, drove to her lab, and immediately began work designing an experiment that was both startlingly simple and frighteningly bold. She had no idea if it would work, and she decided not to tell Peter about her idea until her work was complete. It took 4 months, but finally Catherine brought her brother into the lab. She wheeled out a large piece of gear that she had been keeping hidden in the back storage room.
"I designed and built it myself," she said, showing Peter her invention. "Any guesses?"
Her brother stared at the strange machine.
"An incubator?"
Catherine laughed and shook her head, although it was a reasonable guess. The machine did look a bit like the transparent incubators for premature babies one saw in hospitals. This machine, however, was adult size. A long, airtight, clear plastic capsule, like some kind of futuristic sleeping pod. It sat atop a large piece of electronic gear.
"See if this helps you guess,"
Catherine said, plugging the contraption into a power source. A digital display lit up on the machine, its numbers jumping around as she carefully calibrated some dials. When she was done, the display read 0.000000000 kilograms.
"A scale?" Peter asked, looking puzzled. "Not just any scale."
Catherine took a tiny scrap of paper off a nearby counter and laid it gently on top of the capsule. The numbers on the display jumped around again and then settled on a new reading. 0.00081943.25 kilograms.
"High-precision microbalance," she said. "Resolution down to a few micrograms."
Peter still looked puzzled.
"You built a precise scale for a person?"
"Exactly."
She lifted the transparent lid on the machine.
"If I place a person inside this capsule and close the lid, the individual is in an entirely sealed system. Nothing gets in or out. No gas, no liquid, no dust particles. Nothing can escape. Not the person's breath exhalations, evaporating sweat, body fluids, nothing."
Peter ran a hand through his thick head of silver hair, a nervous mannerism shared by Catherine.
Obviously a person would die in there pretty quickly.
She nodded.
6 minutes or so, depending on their breathing rate.
He turned to her.
"I don't get it."
She smiled.
"You will."
Leaving the machine behind, Catherine led Peter into the cube's control room and sat him down in front of the plasma wall. She began typing and accessed a series of video files stored on the holographic drives. When the plasma wall flickered to life, the image before them looked like home video footage. The camera panned across a modest bedroom with an unmade bed, medication bottles, a respirator, and a heart monitor. Peter looked baffled as the camera kept panning and finally revealed, near the center of the bedroom, Catherine's scale contraption. Peter's eyes widened.
"What the?"
The capsule's transparent lid was open, and a very old man in an oxygen mask lay inside. His elderly wife and a hospice worker stood beside the pod. The man's breathing was labored, and his eyes were closed.
"The man in the capsule was a science teacher of mine at Yale," Catherine said. "He and I have kept in touch over the years. He's been very ill. He always said he wanted to donate his body to science. So when I explained my idea for this experiment, he immediately wanted to be a part of it."
Peter was apparently mute with shock as he stared at the scene unfolding before them. The hospice worker now turned to the man's wife.
"It's time. He's ready."
The old woman dabbed her tearful eyes and nodded with a resolute calm.
"Okay."
Very gently, the hospice worker reached into the pod and removed the man's oxygen mask. The man stirred slightly, but his eyes remained closed. Now the worker wheeled the respirator and other equipment off to the side, leaving the old man in the capsule totally isolated in the center of the room. The dying man's wife now approached the pod, leaned down, and gently kissed her husband's forehead. The old man did not open his eyes, but his lips moved, ever so slightly, into a faint, loving smile. Without his oxygen mask, the man's breathing was quickly becoming more labored. The end was obviously near. With an admirable strength and calm, the man's wife slowly lowered the transparent lid of the capsule and sealed it shut, exactly as Catherine had taught her. Peter recoiled in alarm.
Catherine, what in the name of God?
It's okay, Catherine whispered. There's plenty of air in the capsule.
She had seen this video dozens of times now, but it still made her pulse race. She pointed to the scale beneath the dying man's sealed pod. The digital numbers read 51.4534644 kilograms.
That's his body weight, Catherine said.
The old man's breathing became more shallow, and Peter inched forward, transfixed.
This is what he wanted, Catherine whispered. Watch what happens.
The man's wife had stepped back and was now seated on the bed, silently looking on with the hospice worker. Over the course of the next 60 seconds, the man's shallow breathing grew faster, until all at once, as if the man himself had chosen the moment, he simply took his last breath. Everything stopped. It was over. The wife and hospice worker quietly comforted each other. Nothing else happened. After a few seconds, Peter glanced over at Catherine in apparent confusion.
Wait for it, she thought,
redirecting Peter's gaze to the capsule's digital display, which still quietly glowed, showing the dead man's weight. Then, it happened. When Peter saw it, he jolted backward, almost falling out of his chair.
But that's...
He covered his mouth in shock.
I can't...
It was seldom that the great Peter Solomon was speechless. Catherine's reaction had been similar the first few times she saw what had happened. Moments after the man's death, the numbers on the scale had decreased suddenly. The man had become lighter immediately after his death. The weight change was minuscule, but it was measurable, and the implications were utterly mind-boggling. Catherine recalled writing in her lab notes with a trembling hand,
"There seems to exist an invisible material that exits the human body at the moment of death. It has quantifiable mass which is unimpeded by physical barriers. I must assume it moves in a dimension I cannot yet perceive."
From the expression of shock on her brother's face, Catherine knew he understood the implications.
"Catherine,"
he stammered, blinking his gray eyes as if to make sure he was not dreaming.
"I think you just weighed the human soul."
There was a long silence between them. Catherine sensed that her brother was attempting to process all the stark and wondrous ramifications. It will take time. If what they had just witnessed was indeed what it seemed to be, that is, evidence that a soul or consciousness or life force could move outside the realm of the body, then a startling new light had just been shed on countless mystical questions. Transmigration, cosmic consciousness, near-death experiences, astral projection, remote viewing, lucid dreaming, and on and on. Medical journals were filled with stories of patients who had died on the operating table, viewed their bodies from above, and then been brought back to life. Peter was silent, and Catherine now saw he had tears in his eyes. She understood. She had cried, too. Peter and Catherine had lost loved ones, and for anyone in that position, the faintest hint of the human spirit continuing after death brought a glimmer of hope.
"He's thinking of Zachary,"
Catherine thought, recognizing the deep melancholy in her brother's eyes. For years, Peter had carried the burden of responsibility for his son's death. He had told Catherine many times that leaving Zachary in prison had been the worst mistake of his life, and that he would never find a way to forgive himself. A slamming door drew Catherine's attention, and suddenly she was back in the basement, lying on a cold stone table. The metal door at the top of the ramp had closed loudly, and the tattooed man was coming back down. She could hear him entering one of the rooms down the hall, doing something inside, and then continuing along the hall toward the room she was in. As he entered, she could see that he was pushing something in front of him. Something heavy, on wheels. As he stepped into the light, she stared in disbelief. The tattooed man was pushing a person in a wheelchair. Intellectually, Catherine's brain recognized the man in the chair. Emotionally, her mind could barely accept what she was looking at.
Peter?
She didn't know whether to be overjoyed that her brother was alive, or utterly horrified. Peter's body had been shaved smooth. His mane of thick silver hair was all gone, as were his eyebrows, and his smooth skin glistened as if it had been oiled. He wore a black silk gown. Where his right hand should have been, he had only a stump, wrapped in a clean, fresh bandage. Her brother's pain-laden eyes reached out to hers, filled with regret and sorrow.
Peter!
Her voice cracked. Her brother tried to speak, but made only muffled, guttural noises. Catherine now realized he was bound to the wheelchair and had been gagged. The tattooed man reached down and gently stroked Peter's shaved scalp.
I've prepared your brother for a great honor. He has a role to play tonight.
Catherine's entire body went rigid.
No. Peter and I will be leaving in a moment, but I thought you'd want to say goodbye.
Where are you taking him?
She said weakly. He smiled.
Peter and I must journey to the sacred mountain. That is where the treasure lies. The Masonic pyramid has revealed the location. Your friend Robert Langdon was most helpful.
Catherine looked into her brother's eyes.
He killed Robert.
Her brother's expression contorted in agony, and he shook his head violently, as if unable to bear any more pain.
Now, Peter,
the man said, again stroking Peter's scalp.
Don't let this ruin the moment. Say goodbye to your little sister. This is your final family reunion.
Catherine felt her mind welling with desperation.
Why are you doing this?
She shouted at him.
What have we ever done to you? Why do you hate my family so much?
The tattooed man came over and placed his mouth right next to her ear.
I have my reasons, Catherine.
Then he walked to the side table and picked up the strange knife. He brought it over to her and ran the burnished blade across her cheek.
This is arguably the most famous knife in history.
Catherine knew of no famous knives, but it looked foreboding and ancient. The blade felt razor sharp.
Don't worry,
he said.
I have no intention of wasting its power on you. I'm saving it for a more worthy sacrifice, in a more sacred place.
He turned to her brother.
Peter, you recognize this knife, don't you?
Her brother's eyes were wide with a mixture of fear and disbelief.
Yes, Peter. This ancient artifact still exists. I obtained it at great expense, and I have been saving it for you. At long last, you and I can end our painful journey together.
With that, he wrapped the knife carefully in a cloth with all of his other items, incense, vials of liquid, white satin cloths, and other ceremonial objects. Then he placed the wrapped items inside Robert Langdon's leather bag along with the Masonic pyramid and capstone. Catherine looked on helplessly as the man zipped up Langdon's day bag and turned to her brother.
Carry this, Peter, would you?
He set the heavy bag on Peter's lap. Next, the man walked over to a drawer and began rooting around. She could hear small metal objects clinking. When he returned, he took her right arm, steadying it. Catherine couldn't see what he was doing, but Peter apparently could, and he again started bucking wildly. Catherine felt a sudden sharp pinch in the crook of her right elbow, and an eerie warmth ran down around it. Peter was making anguished, strangled sounds and trying in vain to get out of the heavy chair. Catherine felt a cold numbness spreading through her forearm and fingertips below the elbow. When the man stepped aside, Catherine saw why her brother was so horrified. The tattooed man had inserted a medical needle into her vein, as if she were giving blood. The needle, however, was not attached to a tube. Instead, her blood was now flowing freely out of it, running down her elbow, forearm, and onto the stone table.
A human hourglass,
the man said, turning to Peter.
In a short while, when I ask you to play your role, I want you to picture Catherine, dying alone here in the dark.
Peter's expression was one of total torment.
She will stay alive, the man said, for about an hour or so. If you cooperate with me quickly, I will have enough time to save her. Of course, if you resist me at all, your sister will die here, alone, in the dark.
Peter bellowed unintelligibly through his gag.
I know, the tattooed man said,
placing a hand on Peter's shoulder.
This is hard for you, but it shouldn't be. After all, this is not the first time you will abandon a family member.
He paused, bending over and whispering in Peter's ear.
I'm thinking, of course, of your son, Zachary, in Soganluk prison.
Peter pulled against his restraints and let out another muffled scream through the cloth in his mouth.
Stop it!
Catherine shouted.
I remember that night well,
the man taunted as he finished packing.
I heard the whole thing. The warden offered to let your son go, but you chose to teach Zachary a lesson by abandoning him. Your boy learned his lesson, all right, didn't he?
The man smiled.
His loss was my gain.
The man now retrieved a linen cloth and stuffed it deep into Catherine's mouth.
Death,
he whispered to her,
should be a quiet thing.
Peter struggled violently. Without another word, the tattooed man slowly backed Peter's wheelchair out of the room, giving Peter a long, last look at his sister. Catherine and Peter locked eyes one final time. Then he was gone. Catherine could hear them going up the ramp and through the metal door. As they exited, she heard the tattooed man lock the metal door behind him and continue on through the painting of the Three Graces. A few minutes later, she heard a car start. Then the mansion fell silent. All alone in the dark, Catherine lay bleeding. Chapter 108. Robert Langdon's mind hovered in an endless abyss. No light, no sound, no feeling. Only an infinite and silent void. Softness. Weightlessness. His body had released him. He was untethered. The physical world had ceased to exist. Time had ceased to exist. He was pure consciousness now, a fleshless sentience, suspended in the emptiness of a vast universe. Chapter 109. The modified UH-60 skimmed in low over the expansive rooftops of Kalorama Heights, thundering toward the coordinates given to them by the support team. Agent Simpkins was the first to spot the black Escalade parked haphazardly on a lawn in front of one of the mansions. The driveway gate was closed, and the house was dark and quiet. Sato gave the signal to touch down. The aircraft landed hard on the front lawn amid several other vehicles, one of them a security sedan with a bubble light on top. Simpkins and his team jumped out, drew their weapons, and dashed up onto the porch. Finding the front door locked, Simpkins cupped his hands and peered through a window. The foyer was dark, but Simpkins could make out the faint shadow of a body on the floor.
Shit, he whispered. It's Hartman.
One of his agents grabbed a chair off the porch and heaved it through the bay window. The sound of shattering glass was barely audible over the roar of the helicopter behind them. Seconds later, they were all inside. Simpkins rushed to the foyer and knelt over Hartman to check his pulse. Nothing. There was blood everywhere. Then he saw the screwdriver in Hartman's throat.
Jesus.
He stood up and motioned to his men to begin a full search. The agents fanned out across the first floor, their laser sights probing the darkness of the luxurious house. They found nothing in the living room or study, but in the dining room, to their surprise, they discovered a strangled female security guard. Simpkins was fast losing hope that Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon were alive. This brutal killer clearly had set a trap. And if he had managed to kill a CIA agent and an armed security guard, then it seemed a professor and a scientist had no chance. Once the first floor was secure, Simpkins sent two agents to search upstairs. Meanwhile, he found a set of basement stairs off the kitchen and descended. At the bottom of the stairs, he threw on the lights. The basement was spacious and spotless, as if it were hardly ever used. Boilers, bare cement walls, a few boxes. Nothing here at all. Simpkins headed back up to the kitchen, just as his men were coming down from the second floor. Everyone shook their heads. The house was deserted. No one home, and no more bodies. Simpkins radioed Sato with the all-clear and the grim update. When he got to the foyer, Sato was already climbing the stairs onto the porch. Warren Bellamy was visible behind her, sitting dazed and alone in the helicopter with Sato's titanium briefcase at his feet. The OS director's secure laptop provided her with worldwide access to CIA computer systems via encrypted satellite uplinks. Earlier tonight, she had used this computer to share with Bellamy some kind of information that had stunned the man into cooperating fully. Simpkins had no idea what Bellamy had seen. But whatever it was, the architect had been visibly shell-shocked ever since. As Sato entered the foyer, she paused a moment, bowing her head over Hartman's body. A moment later, she raised her eyes and fixed them on Simpkins.
No sign of Langdon or Catherine or Peter Solomon?
Simpkins shook his head. If they're still alive, he took them with him.
Did you see a computer in the house?
Yes, ma'am, in the office.
Show me.
Simpkins led Sato out of the foyer and into the living room. The plush carpet was covered with broken glass from the shattered bay window. They walked past a fireplace, a large painting, and several bookshelves to an office door. The office was wood-paneled with an antique desk and a large computer monitor. Sato walked around behind the desk and eyed the screen, immediately scowling.
Damn it,
she said under her breath. Simpkins circled around and looked at the screen. It was blank. What's wrong? Sato pointed to an empty docking station on the desk.
He uses a laptop. He took it with him.
Simpkins didn't follow. Does he have information you want to see?
No,
Sato replied, her tone grave.
He has information I want nobody to see.
Downstairs in the hidden basement, Catherine Solomon had heard the sounds of helicopter blades, followed by breaking glass and heavy boots on the floor above her. She tried to cry out for help, but the gag in her mouth made it impossible. She could barely make a sound. The harder she tried, the faster the blood began flowing from her elbow. She was feeling short of breath and a little dizzy. Catherine knew she needed to calm down.
Use your mind, Catherine. With all of her intention, she coaxed herself into a meditative state.
Robert Langdon's mind floated through the emptiness of space. He peered into the infinite void, searching for any points of reference. He found nothing. Total darkness, total silence, total peace. There was not even the pull of gravity to tell him which way was up. His body was gone. This must be death. Time seemed to be telescoping, stretching and compressing, as if it had no bearings in this place. He had lost all track of how much time had passed. 10 seconds? 10 minutes? 10 days? Suddenly, however, like distant fiery explosions in far-off galaxies, memories began to materialize, billowing toward Langdon like shock waves across a vast nothingness. All at once, Robert Langdon began to remember. The images tore through him, vivid and disturbing. He was staring up at a face that was covered with tattoos. A pair of powerful hands lifted his head and smashed it into the floor. Pain erupted, and then darkness. Gray light. Throbbing. Wisps of memory. Langdon was being dragged, half-conscious, down, down, down. His captor was chanting something.
Verbum significatium. Verbum omnificum. Verbum perdo.
Chapter 110. Director Sato stood alone in the study, waiting while the CIA Satellite Imaging Division processed her request. One of the luxuries of working in the D.C. area was the satellite coverage. With luck, one of them might have been properly positioned to get photos of this home tonight, possibly capturing a vehicle leaving the place in the last half hour.
Sorry, ma'am, the satellite technician said. No coverage of those coordinates tonight. Do you want to make a reposition request?
No, thanks. Too late.
She hung up. Sato exhaled, now having no idea how they would figure out where their target had gone. She walked out to the foyer where her men had bagged Agent Hartman's body and were carrying it toward the chopper. Sato had ordered Agent Simpkins to gather his men and prepare for the return to Langley, but Simpkins was in the living room on his hands and knees. He looked like he was ill.
You okay?
He glanced up, an odd look on his face.
Did you see this?
He pointed at the living room floor. Sato came over and looked down at the plush carpet. She shook her head, seeing nothing.
Crouch down, Simpkins said. Look at the nap of the carpet.
She did. After a moment, she saw it. The fibers of the carpet looked like they had been mashed down, depressed along two straight lines as if the wheels of something heavy had been rolled across the room.
The strange thing, Simpkins said, is where the tracks go.
He pointed. Sato's gaze followed the faint parallel lines across the living room carpet. The tracks seemed to disappear beneath a large floor-to-ceiling painting that hung beside the fireplace.
What in the world?
Simpkins walked over to the painting and tried to lift it down from the wall. It didn't budge.
It's fixed, he said,
now running his fingers around the edges.
Hold on. There's something underneath.
His finger hit a small lever beneath the bottom edge, and something clicked. Sato stepped forward as Simpkins pushed the frame and the entire painting rotated slowly on its center, like a revolving door. He raised his flashlight and shined it into the dark space beyond. Sato's eyes narrowed.
Here we go.
At the end of a short corridor stood a heavy metal door. The memories that had billowed through the blackness of Langdon's mind had come and gone. In their wake, a trail of red-hot sparks was swirling, along with the same eerie, distant whisper.
Verbum significatium. Verbum omnificum. Verbum perdo.
The chanting continued like the drone of voices in a medieval canticle.
Verbum significatium. Verbum omnificum.
The words now tumbled through the empty void, fresh voices echoing all around him.
Apocalypsis.
Franklin.
Apocalypsis.
Verbum.
Apocalypsis.
Without warning, a mournful bell began tolling somewhere in the distance. The bell rang on and on, growing louder. It tolled more urgently now, as if hoping Langdon would understand, as if urging his mind to follow. Chapter 111. The tolling bell in the clock tower rang for 3 full minutes, rattling the crystal chandelier that hung above Langdon's head. Decades ago, he had attended lectures in this well-loved assembly hall at Phillips Exeter Academy. Today, however, he was here to listen to a dear friend address the student body. As the lights dimmed, Langdon took a seat against the back wall, beneath a pantheon of headmaster portraits. A hush fell across the crowd. In total darkness, a tall, shadowy figure crossed the stage and took the podium.
Good morning,
the faceless voice whispered into the microphone. Everyone sat up, straining to see who was addressing them. A slide projector flashed to life, revealing a faded sepia photograph. A dramatic castle with a red sandstone facade, high square towers, and Gothic embellishments. The shadow spoke again.
Who can tell me where this is?
England, a girl declared in the darkness. This facade is a blend of early Gothic and late Romanesque, making this the quintessential Norman castle and placing it in England at about the 12th century.
Wow,
the faceless voice replied. Someone knows her architecture. Quiet groans all around.
Unfortunately, the shadow added, you missed by 3,000 miles and half a millennium.
The room perked up. The projector now flashed a full-color modern photo of the same castle from a different angle. The castle's Seneca Creek sandstone towers dominated the foreground. But in the background, startlingly close, stood the majestic, white, columned dome of the U.S. Capitol building.
Hold on, the girl exclaimed. There's a Norman castle in D.C.? Since 1855, the voice replied. Which is when this next photo was taken. A new slide appeared, a black and white interior shot, depicting a massive vaulted ballroom, furnished with animal skeletons, scientific display cases, glass jars with biological samples, archaeological artifacts, and plaster casts of prehistoric reptiles. This wondrous castle, the voice said, was America's first real science museum. It was a gift to America from a wealthy British scientist who, like our forefathers, believed our fledgling country could become the land of enlightenment. He bequeathed to our forefathers a massive fortune and asked them to build at the core of our nation an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. He paused a long moment. Who can tell me the name of this generous scientist? A timid voice in front ventured, James Smithson? A whisper of recognition rippled through the crowd. Smithson, indeed, the man on stage replied. Peter Solomon now stepped into the light, his gray eyes flashing playfully. Good morning. My name is Peter Solomon, and I am secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. The students broke into wild applause. In the shadows, Langdon watched with admiration as Peter captivated the young minds with a photographic tour of the Smithsonian Institution's early history. The show began with Smithsonian Castle, its basement science labs, corridors lined with exhibits, salon full of mollusks, scientists who called themselves the curators of crustaceans, and even an old photo of the castle's two most popular residents, a pair of now-deceased owls named Diffusion and Increase. The half-hour slideshow ended with an impressive satellite photo of the National Mall, now lined with enormous Smithsonian museums. As I said when I began, Solomon stated in conclusion, James Smithson and our forefathers envisioned our great country to be a land of enlightenment. I believe today they would be proud. Their great Smithsonian Institution stands as a symbol of science and knowledge at the very core of America. It is a living, breathing, working tribute to our forefathers' dream for America, a country founded on the principles of knowledge, wisdom, and science. Solomon clicked off the slides to an energetic round of applause. The house lights came up along with dozens of eager hands with questions. Solomon called on a small red-haired boy in the middle. Mr. Solomon, the boy said, sounding puzzled, you said our forefathers fled the religious oppression of Europe to establish a country on the principles of scientific advancement. That's correct. But I was under the impression our forefathers were devoutly religious men who founded America as a Christian nation. Solomon smiled. My friends, don't get me wrong. Our forefathers were deeply religious men. But they were deists, men who believed in God, but in a universal and open-minded way. The only religious ideal they put forth was religious freedom. He pulled the microphone from the podium and strode out to the edge of the stage. America's forefathers had a vision of a spiritually enlightened utopia in which freedom of thought, education of the masses, and scientific advancement would replace the darkness of outdated religious superstition. A blonde girl in back raised her hand. Yes? Sir, the girl said, holding up her cell phone. I've been researching you online, and Wikipedia says you're a prominent Freemason. Solomon held up his Masonic ring. I could have saved you the data charges. The students laughed. Yes, well, the girl continued, hesitating. You just mentioned outdated religious superstition, and it seems to me that if anyone is responsible for propagating outdated superstitions, it would be the Masons. Solomon seemed unfazed. Oh? How so? Well, I've read a lot about Masonry, and I know you've got a lot of strange ancient rituals and beliefs. This article online even says that Masons believe in the power of some kind of ancient magical wisdom, which can elevate man to the realm of the gods? Everyone turned and stared at the girl as if she were nuts. Actually, Solomon said, she's right. The kids all spun around and faced front, eyes widening. Solomon suppressed a smile and asked the girl, Does it offer any other wiki wisdom about this magical knowledge? The girl looked uneasy now,
but she began to read from the website.
To ensure this powerful wisdom could not be used by the unworthy, the early adepts wrote down their knowledge in code.